This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Technik, die bewegt. Design, das begeistert. Erlebe Elektromobilität in neuem Licht. Mit dem neuen innovativen Kia EV4 und dem neuen geräumigen SUV Kia EV5. Entdecke beide vollelektrischen Modelle ab 17. Januar bei uns.
Kia. Movement that inspires.
The world is on the brink. Wars, contentious elections, disinformation spreading at warp speed, and Donald Trump at the center of all of it. But what does it mean for the rest of us? Every week on Pod Save the World, Tommy Vietor and I cut through the noise to explain how global power is shifting. No jargon, no homework, just clear, honest conversations about what's happening and why it matters. From breaking news to long simmering international conflicts, we dissect it all with critical analysis and some jokes that will surely embarrass our children one day. Tune in to Pod Save the World every Wednesday, wherever you get your podcasts, or catch it on YouTube.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Welcome to Lady Killers with me, Lucy Worsley, from BBC Radio 4. Join me and an all-female team of detectives as we travel back in time to revisit the unthinkable crimes of some of the most notorious murderesses of the 19th and 20th centuries from the UK, the USA and Australia. In this final episode of Series 3, we've picked out for you four of the most difficult and contradictory murderesses of the series. Now, let's be clear, by difficult, in some ways, I mean difficult, like any of us might be, women whose behaviour clashes with the social norms and expectations of the time. But of course, what makes these women truly different from you or I is that they have a very dark side indeed. This episode contains material that some listeners may find distressing.
He left me with no money and was going to take the children away from me. I was not going to allow him to do so.
If I wish to take anybody's life, why should I not take that of my husband, who is the greatest enemy to me in the world?
I won't let you break the engagement. I love you and would kill before I would see you taken from me.
The commission sentences Mary E. Surratt to be hanged by the neck until she be dead.
The stories of Mary Surratt, Alice Mitchell, Mary Ann Brough and Maria Manning. All of them are accused of murder. They are anti-heroines. They broke society's moral codes. They did unspeakable things. They couldn't be more difficult than that. To discuss these four cases and the theme of difficult women, I'm delighted to be joined by Helen Lewis, author of the brilliant book Difficult Women, A History of Feminism in 11 Fights. Helen's a staff writer at The Atlantic and former deputy editor of The New Statesman. Hello, Helen.
Hello.
And I'm also joined by our superb in-house historian, Professor Rosalind Crone. Hi, Ros.
Hello, and hello, Helen.
Helen, first of all, the question for you. What was the inspiration behind your book, Difficult Women?
I think lots of my writing over the last couple of years has been about demolishing neat narratives. And I think that's what's interesting to me about these murderesses. They are doing something incredibly unfeminine, unconventional for the time, against all the ideas that we have about women. And that's why I wanted to write Difficult Women too, was about looking at women who had dared to do something very unfeminine, which is stand up and say, I'm extremely important and you should listen to me. And they weren't always likable. Some of them had very, I think, appalling political views, as well as other things that we would champion. And I liked that too. I didn't like that idea of feminist history as a kind of hunt for heroines. Just like, rah, 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 aren't these women brilliant? No, they were complicated. And the only reason that they made change was because they were complicated.
Hmm. Do you have an aversion to the phrase strong women?
I really do. I think it's very reductive. When you look at the great male characters of literature, whether it is Hamlet or Sherlock Holmes, you know, they're often introverted, dislikable, selfish, opinionated. They don't do things in this neat and simple way. And that's the kind of level of complexity that I want to bring to writing about women.
So you want your characters, your subjects, to be remembered, warts and all, the full picture, you'd say, which is what we aim to do here at Lady Killers, to see our murderesses in the round. Were they out and out baddies? Or were there factors about the society in which they lived that helped to drive them to commit murder? Now, Roz, turning to you, can we get carried away drawing parallels between present-day feminist struggles and these women of the past?
Yes. Now, I think it's interesting to start with something you wrote in your book about your dislike of these anthologies of great women for little girls, because I share that dislike. But actually, it's not so unusual. Even back in the 17th century, there were narratives being produced about godly women, you know, that listed all the wonderful things they did and also the books they read and kind of packaged them up as this beautiful tale that then girls would mimic and copy, you know, when they grew up. And in the 19th century, there was quite an industry of these hagiographical accounts of wonderful women, again, packaged up for girls to follow. So it's kind of interesting. I think, you know, that there's a long historical trajectory of looking for particular role models for girls to copy. In terms of presentism, yes, I think that's an interesting point too. And I'm often struck by today the period dramas on television that give these female characters, I would say, a kind of a poise and a voice and a way of speaking that I do not recognise as a historian and I see as quite modern.
Before we start to look at our very own difficult lady killers today, I'd like to ask Helen and Ross, are you difficult women?
I think I absolutely am. I mean, I've been writing on the internet for more than 10 years, and one thing that has been a constant in that time is people violently disagreeing with me. And sometimes I would love to say it's because they disagree with what I've written. Sometimes it does come inflected with, why are you even speaking at all? And I think that to stand and say, look at me still, to be seeking attention is something that's still considered to be quite unfeminine.
What about you, Roz?
I'm almost tempted to say, I think you should ask my colleagues and my husband if I'm a difficult woman. But no, I actually don't see myself as a difficult woman at all, because I wouldn't like to isolate myself and seeing myself as having particular qualities that go against an idea of womanhood in a way that other women are somehow conforming. So I guess I have a bit of an issue with this idea of using difficult women beyond trying to dismantle a stereotype.
Ross, I would say you can be situationally difficult in a positive way.
Thank you, Lucy. I'm going to take that as a compliment.
It is meant as one, most sincerely. Now, we are going to look at our cases through different lenses. The lenses of politics, motherhood, sexuality and virtue. We're going to start in the world of politics with Mary Surratt, a passionate supporter of the Confederate cause in the USA. Little refresher in case you need it. The states had been embroiled in a bitter civil war with the Southern Confederacy fighting to preserve slavery. Mary Surratt, her son and their accomplices cannot accept the victory of the Northern states. And in her boarding house, a plot is made to assassinate the opposition's leader, President Abraham Lincoln. Although it's a young man called John Wilkes Booth who shoots the president, Mary is hanged for the crime. Here's the fateful moment when Mary finds out what she's been accused of.
In further prosecution of said conspiracy, Mary E. Surratt at Washington City did receive, entertain, harbor and conceal, aid and assist John Wilkes Booth and his Confederates.
Roz, it's 1865. How unusual is it for a woman like Mary to get involved in politics like that?
I think it's probably a lot less unusual than you would think. Certainly we know that women were involved in politics at this time and time before as well, but they were involved in politics in less overt ways than men. And often forms of their involvement have been suppressed in the historical record. They haven't been written down to the extent that, of course, men's involvement has. In the case of Mary Surratt, of course, this involvement is quite unusual and in planning an assassination. We also need to remember the context of war here. And wars in history tend to encourage female participation in areas in a more overt way or in a greater way than we would expect in times that are not times of conflict, because of course men are called away to war and so women are left to pick up some of the pieces in their absence. What I also find interesting about the context of this case though is the porous boundary between the public and the private. So it's the fact that she's getting involved as a conspirator, she's planning this within her boarding house, which is a sort of domestic setting, right? This is where people come to stay and she looks after them and she cooks for them and she, you know, they have their beds made and all the rest of it. So there's kind of domestic overlap that's really interesting here. And certainly in her trial, they alluded to this and they made references to her nest, you know, where all this stuff was being planned. So for me, this case is fantastic in showing that the way that women moved from the domestic to the public and their involvement in politics in ways we might not expect.
Now, Helen, you've looked at the suffragettes, how Emmeline and Christabel Pankhurst persuaded so many women to join a militant political cause, risking injury, imprisonment, torture, and death to get the vote for women. The suffragettes were extremely difficult, but they haven't always been portrayed that way. Why did you want to repaint the picture?
Well, my vision of the suffragettes going in, probably the same as lots of other people's, is the mother from Mary Poppins, you know, very posh woman in a bonnet going off and leaving her kids at home with the maid so that she can be involved in this sort of little dilettante movement that's given her a bit of life and purpose. And they really were not like that. You know, had the First World War not happened, that bombing campaign was escalated, they would have killed people. And it's interesting to me that, you know, Emily Davison is held up as the kind of great heroine because she's a martyr. The injury that she did was to herself, throwing herself under the King's horse at the Derby. But they were quite prepared by the end to do the injury to other people too. And that to me is fascinating because they're the opposite of Mary Surratt, which is that they have ended up on the right side of history. Everyone has decided that women did in fact deserve the vote and everything that they did has been interpreted through that lens of being on the winning side.
Do you think that there's a duty to show just how far they would go with their violence and terror?
I certainly felt like that because I feel, you know, it is very easy to apply this backwards lens where everything is read through what happened next. But I think it was important for me to restore what it was like to live through the suffrage movement in the present tense. And, you know, they were surveilled by the Home Office. They were imprisoned. They were force-fed. They were tortured. And they became incredibly, some of them, incredibly radicalised.
Helen, do you see any modern-day parallels with our case of Mary Surratt?
I think Mary Surratt getting written out of the story is a classic thing that happens to women in politics. You know, you think about the great female politicians of the 20th century. Perhaps the greatest prime minister we never had, the Labour politician Barbara Castle. She brought in seatbelts and a speed limit. You know, she formed the Overseas Development Department. She had a huge impact on 20th century politics, but she's really very little remembered today. Trade unions, another classic example. We think of them as being very male institutions. The average trade unionist in this country is a woman. They are the foot soldiers.
Is that right?
Of a political movement. Yeah, it is a woman in her 40s that is the most dominant group in trade unions. They are the people who turn up, they push the leaflets through the door, they make the tea, they organise the mailing list, they do all the hard admin work that makes so many political movements run. What they don't tend to do is get the bit where everybody crowds around them and tells them that they're wonderful. And I think that's perhaps to me one of the reasons that Mary Surratt has been written out of this story is that she was kind of cast into an administrative role.
Right, on to our next selected difficult woman and the theme of motherhood. This particular lady killer dwelt for some time on the fringes of politics, but that was through her paid work rather than political enthusiasm. We're talking about Mary Ann Brough, who was the wet nurse employed by Queen Victoria. Mary breastfed the Prince of Wales. She even went to his christening before being sacked, allegedly found drunk in the nursery by Queen Victoria herself. Later, Mary's husband discovers that Mary's having an affair and threatens her with divorce. In an act of desperation to avoid her husband getting custody of their six children, one fateful night, Mary slits the throats of her poor innocent infants.
I saw one child lying on the window with his throat cut. In another room found three children, all with their throats cut and quite dead.
Now, this case is interesting to think about because Mary's behaviour goes so much against ideas of motherhood then, and I'd also argue now. Helen, what's your reaction to it?
I think it's interesting to me because it reminds me of the story of Medea, which is the classical story of what we would now call family annihilation. And the very odd thing about family annihilation is it is almost exclusively a crime committed by men. And the classic version of that is that a couple split up and then there is something that happens almost like the father says, well, if I can't have the kids, no one will. And that, I don't think, is what's happened here. But I question myself in saying that about whether or not those feelings of entitlement and rage might also be felt by a mother. And are we imposing a different kind of stereotype on this case by saying, well, of course, a mother would never act in this vengeful way. She must have been doing it because she was so afraid of losing her children, and extending more sympathy to her because she's a woman.
Well, making the series totally has made me call myself out on all sorts of stereotypes that I hold. Roz, what do you think? Mary murders her own children, but to what extent do the custody laws of the time, which could have taken these children away from her, to what extent does that excuse her?
Yeah, well, we chose this case deliberately because we wanted to get at that theme. You know, it was a way into exploring that particular area. And again, it's something you've written about in your book, which is great. So just going back to recap, in the 19th century, if you divorced from your husband, which was incredibly difficult to do, the custody of the children automatically went to the man. He was basically the owner of the kids. And there were little loopholes, of course, following 1839, for example. Under certain circumstances, children of the age of 7 and below could be given to their mother. But if you had committed adultery, of course, you couldn't have that. And in this case, that's what Mary had been accused of. And there was evidence, you know, that the husband had in his hand. I think it's really interesting that this case, you know, although we have the custody element to it, it didn't give rise to any kind of debate about those custody laws or anything. That was very much swept under the carpet. And it was because they went down the road of the insanity defense. It was also a way of the Victorians tidying it away because they couldn't imagine a mother possibly doing this, possibly killing 6 children in one night. And so it's a very easy way to explain the unexplainable.
Now, this brings us to an interesting parallel, Helen, with your book. You look at Marie Stopes, synonymous with the provision of birth control access across the world. But she also had a very dark side. She was an admirer of Hitler and a eugenicist. How did you approach her?
Well, I think she's one of the people I was most interested in. I mean, for a start, she's just a fantastic character. She is quite bonkers in a lot of ways. She moves to a tent in the, you know, on the seaside just before the breaking out of the First World War, where she writes a sort of strange masturbation diary. I mean, she knew how to make her own entertainment, let's put it that way. But, you know, also on the eve of the Second World War, she did send this letter to Hitler saying, here's a volume of my poetry, and, you know, love is the greatest thing in the world. So she's just a fascinating character. There's that for a start. But I also wanted to talk about the way that birth control has always been tied up in ideas about natalism and about who should have children, how many children should they have, are the wrong people having children? And that's been part of the birth control movement from the start. And the other thing I wanted to put as a challenge to modern readers was, you get an email from somebody, let's update it, saying, I've got 9 children, I'm 37, I've had a uterine prolapse, my doctor won't tell me how to stop me having another baby. How does that make you feel? How would that make you perhaps even susceptible to the eugenics movement? And if there's anything that I can do with the book, it's about putting these people back into their context and actually saying to modern people, you think you would have been so much better than this. Are you absolutely sure that you would have been?
It's very easy to be condescending about people in the past. That's all too true. Let's move on to the theme of sexuality. In the case of Alice Mitchell, we're in Memphis, Tennessee in 1892. Alice transgresses pretty much every boundary for middle-class female Victorians. She meets and falls in love with another woman, Frieda Ward, at the Higbee School for Young Ladies, and then plans to assume a male identity so that the two can marry. But when Frieda breaks it off, broken-hearted Alice makes a terrifying decision.
Then indeed I resolved to kill Frieda, because I loved her so much that I wanted her to die loving me.
As Frieda is about to board a Mississippi steamer, Alice slits her throat with a razor. Helen, you talk about the way we airbrush or discard women from history if they don't fit. It would be really tempting, I feel, at this present moment, to cherry-pick only the positive stories from queer history and to leave Alice out of the story. Why do you think it's important that we don't?
Well, telling the full story of women's history, as Ladykillers does, is about humanising women, about showing them in all their complexity. It's saying that women are just as complicated and run the full spectrum between good and evil as men do. And I think we should say exactly the same thing about LGBT people. And that, you know, is difficult when you have a culture of kind of pride parades, which are done for a very good and specific reason, about saying we're here, we're not going anywhere. And it's a celebratory movement. That's one thing. History is not that. History is about representing people in their actual circumstances. And I think this case is interesting because you're looking at people who lived in a kind of complicated contradiction between gender and sexuality. if they passed as a straight couple, they would have been able to perhaps live. And we know that there's examples from the 18th century of that happening, court cases around, you know, so-called female husbands. So this was something that people lived with and negotiated their way through. And, you know, it's something that's happened to gay people throughout history, about the idea about not seeming too gay or making accommodations. Just restore the complexity to LGBT stories just as much as to women's stories.
Well, Alice might not be a heroine. We can, I think, admire her for trying to break the mould and to live differently from the expectations of her time.
Yes, that's an interesting one. So was she trying to break the mould? When new groups get their rights in society, there's a little bit of a danger. They look back in the past and they rummage around to find their history. And it's what we start to call identity history as historians in recent times. And this is a case for women and the rise of women's history. And it's more recently the case for gay and lesbian people, where you reach back and you try to find you in the past. Now, on the one hand, there's nothing wrong with that, because I do think that the aim of history is to really expose the diversity of human experience. And that's a wonderful thing. And the more diversity we expose, I think the deeper our understanding of the past and human society. So that's a good thing. But there's always a danger in looking back and saying, see, there are people like me. Because it develops this tunnel vision and it removes the context and the process from history. Yes, same-sex desire is a constant, but it manifests itself in different ways. And I think we've got to be careful not to see these people as radical champions of something, but to see them within their time, and also to understand their motivations and what they're trying to do.
Last but not least of our difficult lady killers is Maria Manning. Maria, in case you need a recap, lives in Bermondsey, southeast London, and she's Swiss. Maria is married, but she has an affair with a man called Patrick O'Connor. Later, she colludes with her husband to kill him.
We premeditated to take his life. To our home, invited him one Thursday night. The murderous weapons we had prepared. And we trepanned him into a fatal snare.
While the ideal Victorian woman was modest and chaste, the angel of the house, Maria is completely the opposite of this. Her home is very far from being a domestic idyll. In fact, she has buried her lover right at the heart of it, underneath the kitchen floor. Maria's also definitely the stronger partner of her and her husband. Helen, what are your feelings about this case?
When I was listening to the episode, I was thinking, well, that's very strange, isn't it, that she managed to negotiate this relationship with these two men? You know, who's the one, the primary one, the one that came first? Because I expected it would be her and the lover would murder the husband. You know, I feel that's a more classical way for that story to go. And then the moment that you found out that she double-crossed them and she was away to Edinburgh, leaving the husband in the, you know, on the hook for it all, was really shocking to me. So I like this case because it did not go in the ways that I expected. And she comes out of it as being definitely the primary mover in all of this.
I know that yay girl history is bad, we don't do that. But do you feel a little yay moment with this one?
I don't think I would describe it as a yay moment. But I certainly thought, I appreciated the way it confounded my expectations about what this case would be. And I have to say, Roz, I am dying to know, what do you think was going on sexually with these people?
Yeah, no, it's a difficult one because I don't think the historic record really reveals enough. She met O'Connor first, actually, apparently while she was crossing the channel. Because she was a lady's maid and she was on a voyage, and he was crossing the channel as a customs officer. She, I think, would have liked to have married him because he had a bit of money, despite the fact he was also a very shady character. But in the end, he wasn't proposing, so she married the railway guard instead.
Was he a very understanding railway guard who knew that the affair was continuing, or was that, we think, about a surprise to him when he found out about that?
Well, they moved away together down to Devon. I don't think it continued while they were there. But when they came back to London, she rekindled it with O'Connor. And actually, yes, I think Frederick knew about this.
They give the impression that they're all involved in some sort of steampunk subculture where none of the normal rules apply. Make a great film, this one. Now, Helen, you write in your book about the concept of the Victorian angel in the home and how feminism has to fight the tyranny of niceness. What's wrong with being nice?
Well, the problem with being nice is that it can so often mean being conformist. And there's nothing wrong with being kind to people and being polite and being respectful. But sometimes you have to actually say, no, this is wrong. And that's the bit that feminism absolutely has to do. It has to draw attention to itself. It has to set boundaries for women. The problem that feminism has is whenever you do some feminism, people will tell you that shouldn't you be doing something else instead? Aren't there infinitely more important causes? And to do feminism is therefore to kind of claim that space, which is fundamentally in odds with our idea about what womanhood is and has traditionally been.
Picking up on your account of feminism and needing to stand up and say things, it certainly comes across in your book as well that we have all these women that you've picked out, which are fantastic. But I do worry as a historian myself and a gender historian at that, that we forget the ordinary women in that picture and what the ordinary women contribute to all of this. So the women who are not famous names, so that the bulk of us and what we're doing every day. And what I think historians have been really good at doing over the last 20 to 25 years, kind of like the run of my career so far, is giving agency back to ordinary people, not assuming that they are actually conforming, but they're all pushing the boundaries in their own way. And they're not all carbon copies, all doing the right thing and all being kind and nice. And there's just a few people who stand up and say, I won't have this anymore. That actually there is a swell. And that's a very interesting thing to study in itself. And we get these great people that emerge and are able to push change, but often because there's a swell that's been happening for a while in preparation for that person to stand up and then be the pusher of the change finally.
I think that's a really fair point, because what often happens is you get a moment where it seems like a switch has flicked and something has changed enormously. And actually there's been years and years of work going into that. The suffragette cause is, I think, a really good example of that. So now the fashion is much more in favour of the suffragettes because they're exciting. And we aren't so excited by the marches and leafleting and many years of careful campaigning, over 100 years of taking petitions to Parliament. You know, this kind of boring grunt work that doesn't seem inflammatory and exciting, but was really necessary because it convinced, in the end, a big enough block of people that this was a just cause. And actually, at the moment that the suffragettes came along and sprinkled that stardust on it, they did so on a bedrock. So I think that's a very fair point to make.
But Helen, could you get a book deal writing about the ones who pushed the leaflets through the door?
This is the problem of story, and it's something that historians have been grappling, right? We talk about the great man theory of history. There is a sort of great woman theory of history that is a problem too, where it's easy to write about exceptional individuals and their incredible, exciting lives. It's rather harder to write about the slow boring of hard boards. That was the description of politics by Max Weber. You know, that is what actually happens. It happens in sort of boring meeting rooms and committees and, you know, over the tea and at 7 p.m. on a rainy Tuesday. And it's very hard to write about.
Mm. And it also happens in kitchens and in sculleries and all the rest of it. And that hard grind of women and how they're negotiating boundaries and space all the time.
Do you know, I've got a feeling that some of our lady killers community, some of our listeners might well be the slow borers of hard boards. Okay, let's be in no doubt that all of the lady killers we've talked about in this series committed unspeakable crimes. They're anti-heroines, breaking taboos around sexuality, motherhood, and sexual relationships. But just as Helen set out to understand feminist heroines more fully, I think it's vital that our anti-heroines are also seen in the round. And why does all of this matter? Because I believe that if we can get a bit closer to understanding the diversity of women's lives in the past, then we can all get a little bit closer to understanding ourselves. Well, a huge thank you to Helen Lewis and Professor Rosalind Crone. And it's goodbye for now from me and from all of us here at Lady Killers. We really hope that you've enjoyed the series as much as we've enjoyed making it. Lady Killers with Lucy Worsley is produced by Emily Hughes, and the series producer is Julia Habel. Sound design is by Chris McLean. It's a Story Hunter production for BBC Radio 4. And you can catch up with the whole series if you search for Lady Killers on BBC Sounds. If you want to know even more about how we bring these fascinating stories to life for this podcast, you can join Roz and I for an exclusive behind-the-scenes chat about what it takes to make Lady Killers. Go to bbc.co.uk and search for Lady Killers, where you can follow the links to the Open University.
Hi, I'm Kirsty Young, and this is Young Again, my podcast for BBC Radio 4, where I get the chance to meet some of the world's most noteworthy and intriguing people and ask them the question, if you knew then what you know now, what would you tell yourself?
I don't regret anything in my life.
You don't?
No, no way.
Oh, if we could only turn back.
For me, well, I'd probably tell my younger self to slow down, not to be so judgmental, that all that worrying was wasted energy and that a perm is always a bad idea.
This might be the best therapy I've had all year, by the way.
Okay.
So you
and
never
no
know.
Charge. Join me for some frank and, I hope, fascinating exchanges. Subscribe to Young Again on BBC Sounds.
Technik, die bewegt. Design, das begeistert. Erlebe Elektromobilität in neuem Licht. Mit dem neuen innovativen Kia EV4 und dem neuen geräumigen SUV Kia EV5. Entdecke beide vollelektrischen Modelle ab 17. Januar bei uns. Kia. Movement that inspires.
The world is on the brink. Wars, contentious elections, disinformation spreading at warp speed, and Donald Trump at the center of all of it. But what does it mean for the rest of us? Every week on Pod Save the World, Tommy Vietor and I cut through the noise to explain how global power is shifting. No jargon, no homework, just clear, honest conversations about what's happening and why it matters. From breaking news to long simmering international conflicts, we dissect it all with critical analysis and some jokes that will surely embarrass our children one day. Tune in to Pod Save the World every Wednesday, wherever you get your podcasts, or catch it on YouTube.